Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. And I am sitting in a YWAM base on the west coast of Sweden. And so I'm in a different time zone. In fact, it's 11 o'clock at night for me. I will be going to bed as soon as the program is over. And I'm teaching for the School of Biblical Studies here this week. I'll be back in the United States before the end of the week. Possible. All you have to do is dial this toll-free number, 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. And we're going to talk first to Nathan, who's calling from Imperial, California. Nathan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I'd always heard. I've always heard that. A number of teachers that I expected in the past say that there are gaps and such, the genealogies in the Bible. And I'm going through them. That's not immediately apparent to me. And I'm just wondering how they come to that conclusion and what you think about that.
Okay. Now, when you talk about the genealogies you're looking at, are you talking about Genesis chapter 5 and Genesis chapter 11?
I assume that's what the ones that they're referring to. Yes. I'm not entirely sure, but there
might be gaps in those genealogies has been suggested, partly because there's exactly 10 generations listed from Adam to Noah, and then exactly the same number of generations, 10, from Noah to Abraham. And sometimes people think that, although that of course could be true, they think that it's rather symmetrical. It has the look of being maybe artificially structured to have 10 generations, just like Matthew in Matthew chapter 1, when he is giving the genealogy of Christ, he breaks up the whole genealogy. Looks like we lost a connection with you, so I'm going to have to hang that up because we've got an echo there. Matthew breaks up the whole genealogy from Abraham to Christ into three equal groups of 14 names. Now, to do that, Matthew has to leave out some names here and there. Several of the kings of Israel, at least three of the kings of Israel, are left out of the genealogy in order to make that symmetry that you find. Sometimes the listing of names in a genealogy was not so much attempting to give every name in a person's genealogy as to make the high points of the genealogy memorable. And therefore, Matthew, as I say, takes all the time from Abraham to Christ and divides it into three groups of 14 generations, which is only artificially done by leaving some names out. Now, that is known to happen. We know Matthew did that. We don't know if Moses did that in Genesis, but some people have speculated that he might have, because you have that symmetry there, too. You've got exactly 10 generations in chapter 5. From Adam to Noah, then you pause to have the story of Noah for several chapters, and then you have 10 generations from Noah to Abram, and then of course you pause there to study the life of Abraham and of his descendants. And it's just the sameness of the two lists that's made some people suggest the possibility that it may be artificially made that length by leaving out certain names, and there might be some gaps there. We would have actually no way of knowing. And therefore, it's only a theory. It's not a necessary theory, but it's one that isn't entirely crazy. We know that Matthew has done this, and we can know that because we can compare the genealogies in Matthew with the genealogies of the kings in the Old Testament. And we can see where Matthew has left some out. But in the case of Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, we don't have any opportunity to compare those genealogies with any other records of that same period of time. And therefore, we will never know, perhaps, if those genealogies are complete. Now, they do look complete, because in most cases, especially in Genesis 5, it tells us this man was so many years old when he became the father of this man. And then he lived this many more years, and then he died. And then it says it goes through the same pattern with the next guy. And it does look like there are all, that all the years are accounted for. And therefore, many people would say there are no gaps in those genealogies in Genesis. The way they're written sounds like they're airtight. And so you're going to have differences of opinion about that, and those are the reasons that people wonder. Let's talk to Michelle from Smithton, Illinois. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. My question is more of like a family concern or issue, and I'm just looking for some biblical clarity on how to handle the situation.
Okay.
My parents have been divorced for, I guess it's going on about 24 years, and their relationship has always kind of been full of jealousy and deceptions and excuses and just real volatile at times, sometimes verbal and physical abuse. And
you mean in the years since the divorce?
They were divorced for, let's see, like I said, they've been divorced for 24 years, but they have been living back together. I guess you could consider it reconciling, which never really reconciled. There's always been this, dysfunctional unit.
They're back under the same roof, but there's a lot of jealousy and
off and on, actually, since the divorce. And then they did, yes, move back in together after, like, all the kids were out of the house kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And since their last, I guess, quarrel or fight, my mother had said that she couldn't stay there anymore. She couldn't do it. And so my husband and I offered our home to her, and she did this time, you know, leave, which she had said, you know, so many times that she was going to and just never did. And we had talked to, you know, about reconciling with him, and she just felt like that was something that was never going to be able to happen, because she had felt that there were so many things that were unresolved that he wouldn't admit to. So she couldn't trust him kind of thing. And shortly after she moved in with us, they began, you know, conversing again and spending time together, and she would go over there, or they would go to lunch or whatever. And so I was concerned, because I, you know, thought that her coming here was the fresh start she needed and had said she wanted. And so I confronted her and asked her, I said, well, are you trying to work things back out? Or, you know, I thought you were trying to move forward, because you said you've spent so many years of your life in the same situation that you couldn't do it anymore. She said no, that, you know, she didn't want to go back, and that she was going to talk to him, and they were going to just, you know, separate and go each their own way. And that conversation she had with him about 6 weeks ago, after I had asked her about it, and within a week it was back to the same old thing again, which is awkward.
Back to them arguing, or back to them living together?
No, she's still living here, and he's still living the same place he was, not with us.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're, you know, again, spending the time together, talking. He'll come over, which I have a fine relationship with both of them, but since this, it just feels really awkward, you know. I don't feel like either one is being honest enough with the other. And I have four children, and I know that it's confusing for them and myself and my husband, and I do have a two-week-old, so the newborn is thrown in the mix. And I guess I'm at a point where I don't know. It's like I'm trying to keep the emotional, irrational part out of it, because it's been a lifelong thing that this is just how it's been.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to keep that away from the Christian view of, you know, what the loving thing is to do, and am I supporting something that I shouldn't, because, you know, the awkwardness of the relationship, the confusion with the kids not understanding, and for the most part, myself not understanding, you know, if you're making a decision to start fresh, that's fine. If you're making a decision to reconcile, then be reconciled. But, you know, neither party is willing to, I guess, make that commitment as far as it really needs to be made.
Okay, so if I understand, they legally got divorced 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And then a while ago they got not too many years ago, they got back together, but they didn't remarry. They just began to live together again for a while, and that didn't work out, so they split up, and now they're talking again. And you see the situation, you see their relationship as an unhealthy relationship because of the way they relate to each other, and your children are confused by what? By the fact that grandma and grandpa are seeing each other but not living together, or by your mother's indecision, apparently, or she's saying one thing and seemingly doing another.
Right. I think both. My oldest, asks, why don't you live there anymore? Or how long are you going to be living here? Or where are you going? Oh, you're going with grandpa. You know, it's like, okay, if you're not living there and everything was fine before, why are you still doing things with him, but you're living here now? You know, mm-hmm. I think the confusion of where is this going, and if it's an issue of why you left, and the fear and the dishonesty and all the things that took you away from the situation, why put yourself back in it if you're not
now you're,
really trying to reconcile?
Right. Now, would you be opposed to them reconciling? Do you think their relationship is too unhealthy, or is it that you think they're not reconciling, they're just playing games?
That's a hard one. I don't think that their relationship is healthy whatsoever, and it mm-hmm. and it hasn't been as long as I can remember.
Okay. Well, it's not your responsibility to be the adult and to parent your parents. I know, and
I grew up living in this situation, and it drove me crazy because I couldn't understand it. Now I've subjected my whole household to it, and I guess I'm trying to figure out what's the right thing to do, what's the fair thing to do, and still be loving and being led by God more than an emotion or a feeling that that this is.
Well, let me ask you this, Michelle. You had your mother come live with you. I assume that was her only option apart from living with him. Did she have the possibility of getting her own apartment and not living with you?
Financially, if it worked out that she could
do
afford,
that.
Yeah.
Because she did live separately from him for many years.
We lived in a trailer that actually my family owned, my uncle owned, so we were able to live there, basically next to nothing.
Let me see if I understand, and if I can suggest something. It sounds like your parents are not behaving, in your opinion, at least not very maturely, not very responsibly. They seem to be indecisive about what they're going to do in their relationship and with their lives, and you feel like your family's and your children are kind of caught in the middle while the decisions are being made or not being made, and it's confusing to the kids and all of that. First of all, if your parents have been kind of, not very mature in their relationship all your adult life, and you've been the mature one, you might feel some responsibility to guard your mom from getting back involved with him or something like that. But, of course, that's not your responsibility. She's an adult. Your father's an adult. They can make their mistakes you don't have to, you're not responsible. You can counsel them. You know, if you think that she's making a wrong decision, you can say, I don't really think this is a good idea. But, ultimately, she's going to have to make her own decisions as an adult, and so is he, and they may make decisions you don't agree with, and you can't stop that. What you can do is decide that they're not going to be in limbo about this in your house. You could say to your mom, I don't know if you're ever going to reconcile with Dad or not. You say you don't want to, but you're kind of hanging out with them, and maybe you are going to reconcile, and basically, I don't know if it's good, bad, or otherwise for them to reconcile. I think, in general, it's good. You think their relationship's unhealthy, so their reconciling might not make a lot of sense. But that's really, I'm afraid, for them to work out. And if they do something that's really unacceptable to you and to your husband, and in as far as what your children are having to watch, the one thing you can do is ask your mom to find another place to live, and to say, this is confusing to our kids. We're not sure what to tell them. It'd just be a lot easier, Mom, if you lived somewhere else and you and Dad could date or do whatever you're going to do, and do it kind of on your own, you know, in your own location, because we don't know what to tell our kids about grandma and grandpa. It seems to me that they're going to do whatever they're going to do. You're not going to stop that. They may end up moving back in together and break up again. They may keep doing that until they get old and die, you know?
Right.
It's hard to say. But that's not really your problem. It seems like it because you're kind of in the middle of it. But that's for them to deal with as a couple of adults making their own decisions, even maybe not very maturely or very responsibly. The main thing is that you and your husband need to just make sure that your home is a sanctuary for your children and you. And if your mother was really needy, I mean, if she really couldn't live anywhere else, if it was a matter of living in your home or living on the street, sleeping on a grate, you know, on the sidewalk, well, then obviously your options would be fewer. But it sounds to me like if she wished, she could arrange her finances to live on her own. And that, not being in the situation, I can't feel exactly the intensity of your discomfort with it, but since it is clearly an uncomfortable situation for you and your husband, I would just suggest that you have her move out and then don't pay any attention to whether she's dating him or whether she's,
reconciling
him and so forth.
What I had said before, it's like if she had her own place, I wouldn't know if he's coming over, if she's talking to him, or what state they're in with it. But since it's just in my face all the time and I don't know, you know, she'll tell me some things or he'll just show up or they'll have a conversation. But it just is confusing to me and to the kids. And I guess from my perspective, I'm just trying to decide or find out if I'm wrong for having the feelings that I'm feeling, if it's something that truly this isn't supposed to be this way and it's, you know, that's normal.
Well, the only way that I could say, the only feelings of yours that I might say might be inappropriate would be if you're starting to take on a parenting role towards your mother and saying, you know, Mom, you know, I don't approve. Sort of like, you know, you have to be in by 10 o'clock and, you know, you can't see this man. But if it's, you know, if you just let her do what she's going to do, unless she was mentally incompetent and needed, you know, her children to guard her from herself, I think she'll probably make some mistakes again. I mean, and it may be that she'll keep making the mistakes, but your only responsibility is to decide whether that's going to go on under your roof or not. And it sounds to me like it shouldn't, just from what you're sharing about your sentiments.
Right. Well, because she, you know, she'll say one thing, but then, you know, obviously her actions don't support what she says. So then I question, is that truly, you know,
what you want,
or are you just afraid to say it, you know, I guess is the bigger thing.
Well, on a big issue like whether you're going to reconcile with your ex-husband that you've been divorced from for 25 years, and whether you're going to give him another chance and those kinds of things, I can understand people, you know, having their days where they feel like the answer is yes and days when the answer is no and being kind of indecisive. But like I say, if it's causing some kind of disruption and confusion and in your home, just ask her to find another place. And I think that that's the answer. As far as your feelings about it, whether they're right or wrong, they're your feelings. You know, feelings are not always right or wrong. They're just the way you feel about it, and it doesn't make you comfortable. And
if it doesn't make you comfortable,
it shouldn't be in your home.
I feel like it's changing our relationship with one another, and then from the very beginning, it felt very strange with my father and I, our relationship, because I felt like they're each playing each other's game, and it's like I don't feel comfortable
Well, Michelle, I actually have other
what's going on.
Yeah, I've got to take some other calls, but I think that that's what I would suggest is just have her find another place to live, and then. And then don't bother yourself with it. I mean, if she tells you what's going on between her and your dad, then there's no reason that you can't listen, but she's at least not doing it in front of your face.
Right. And then the only concern now would be that when I try to explain that she'll just hear that I don't want her here instead of...
Well, right. I don't know your mom. I don't know your mom, and I don't know her reactions. But, I mean, if you explain to her what you explained to me, just say, this is how I feel about it. And if she says, well, you owe it to your mother to have me around, but, well, you don't. I mean, in a sense, unless she needs it. I mean, if she's going to live under your roof, she has to live under your rule. And that's not something she probably really wants to do. And that's a very important thing, it seems to me. I mean, if somebody wants to live under your roof, whether it's a grown child, and your children are not grown yet, mine are, I have grown children living under my roof with me. Whether it's your mother, your father, your grown children, or a total non-relative living under your roof, that's your roof, and you set the standards, and you decide what will be okay and what's not okay. And if your mom is doing things that just aren't okay with you, she may complain about it. But I mean, I think you just need to lay down the expectations. And okay. If she doesn't want to live by them, then she can find another place to live.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve.
All right. Am I going to see you and Sean this weekend at all? I'm going to be in St. Louis.
I think Sean is probably going to make it, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a long drive.
He's 2 weeks old, so I don't know
if he'll
venture out or not.
Yeah, congratulations on that baby.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, Michelle. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Roberta calling from Estacada, Oregon. And we have lines open for you also. If you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, or you have a difference of opinion from the host, you're welcome to call 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Roberta, thank you for calling. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. You are in the home of my ancestors.
in Sweden. You're Swedish, right?
Sweden and Scandinavia on both sides, grandparents.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful, beautiful place.
There's Simonson and Peterson.
Is that right? Well, that's very Scandinavian. Yeah, actually, the leaves are all turning right now, and we don't see that as much in California, where I live, as here. It's very magnificent.
Oh, beautiful.
It's how I imagine New England. I've been to New England many times, but never in the fall. And everyone says you've got to go to New England in the fall because of the leaves colored. I have not managed to see the New English fall, but it's that way here, and it's really great.
It's beautiful here in Oregon. They're starting to turn. I've never left the West Coast, so that's cool. Daniel, I was told there's a study in Daniel that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and some of their friends, as they were brought into Babylon, were made into eunuchs?
Probably.
Do you know where I could find the information?
Well, the reason I say probably is because they were delivered over to a man named Ashpenaz, who to oversee him, and he is said to have been the master of the eunuchs. And so that's the main reason. Also, Daniel, although this is not definitive, there's never any mention of Daniel's marital status. Whereas, say, Jeremiah had a wife, and she died. Isaiah had a wife, and they had a couple of kids whose names were significant. Not Jeremiah. It was Ezekiel had a wife who died. Isaiah had a wife. Jeremiah specifically says he was told not to marry. And Hosea was told to marry. So a lot of times the marital status of the prophets is at least mentioned and sometimes significant. Daniel, by contrast, there's no mention of him being married or not. And yet when he was carried into Babylon along with his friends, they were delivered by Nebuchadnezzar over to the care of a man who is the master of the eunuchs and who was overseeing the king's eunuchs. Usually, when people were made part of the royal court, they were made eunuchs, and there were two reasons for that. And of course, for those who don't know, a eunuch is someone who's been castrated, and in the royal palaces of Eastern kings, they typically made all of their officials eunuchs, or at least many of them, because for one thing, it kept them from being distracted from their work.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they wouldn't be interested in women. And for another thing, if the king had a harem, it kept his workers and his staff away from his women because they were eunuchs. So
someone mentioned the name Josephus to me, that Josephus wrote something about this.
Well, Josephus may have. I mean, Josephus is a Jewish historian,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote a book called, well, he wrote a couple of books. The one I refer to most often is The Wars of the Jews, which is about the Jewish war in 66 to 70 AD. But he also wrote a book called Antiquities of the Jews, where he took the whole history of Israel, and he covered the same ground that the Old Testament covers historically, but he included lots of details that aren't in the Old Testament. Now, I've never read what Josephus said about Daniel, but I wouldn't be surprised if Josephus said that Daniel and his friends were made eunuchs. It'd be the kind of thing that Josephus might mention, and
okay,
which might be true.
You couldn't say for sure or not whether they were or not. My sister's doing the Bible study, and I still might call her back after I talk to you. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no one knows for sure because the Bible doesn't say.
Yeah,
but I think Josephus may have deduced it. No, Josephus, if he did say it, would have deduced it from the same points that I already made.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Josephus would not have any other historical information as his source than
mm-hmm.
what we have in the Old Testament in all likelihood.
So if Josephus said it, it still might not be true?
Right. If Josephus said it, it wouldn't be any more authoritative than you or I saying it based on the particular evidence in the book of Daniel, which is very, very minimal.
Okay. All right. That answers my question. Thank you very much.
Right. But I mean, in brief, sure. But in brief, here it is. Most people in the position that Nebuchadnezzar put those men in,
mm-hmm.
in an Eastern court, would be made eunuchs.
I've read that, yes.
And these men were particularly put under the care of one who is the master of the eunuchs.
Uh-huh.
And Daniel's marital status is never mentioned in the Bible, so he may not have been married. And therefore, those three things would point in the direction of Daniel and his friends probably being eunuchs.
This radio preacher was very well respected. He is doing a study on Daniel, and he said that, and I thought, well, you know, and then I thought, I'll ask, you know, Steve what he thinks about this.
Mm-hmm. I think it's probable.
Probable then. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's not certain, but all the evidence would favor it, I think.
Okay. Thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, Roberta. Thanks for your call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Have a good day. Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Lisa, calling from Portland, Oregon. We have a line open for you also at 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. You can call with questions about the Bible, or you can call with a point of disagreement if you wish. 1-800-438-5090. Lisa, thank you for your call. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question, and I've been trying to figure this out forever. I go to a 12-step meeting, and they say you can have God as you understand him. Well, my God, the way I found Jesus was going to that program, which I go to.
Uh-huh.
It's through the Bible, and I know it says the only way you can come to God is through Jesus. Now, this is what I don't understand. There's people there that have had recovery for years, and they claim their higher power is God, but they don't claim Jesus. And I've been trying mm-hmm. to figure out, how can they say they can get insight from God and their higher power told them to do this and that if they don't have Jesus? This is what I don't understand.
Well, there's always been other religions besides Christianity. There's always been people who worshipped other gods and who acknowledged other gods. And the question I guess maybe you have is why would, if their gods are not genuine,
uh-huh.
or if they don't have a genuine relationship with God, why does it help them?
Yeah, they say, I've only stayed sober all these years because of my higher power, which I call God. And I know because I go to a Jesus-based church, and I used to be in the darkness, too, before I was the same way, and I thought, but now it's totally different.
Okay, well, the question of how they have been helped without necessarily believing in Jesus is, to my mind, not a huge mystery. I mean, for one thing, some people manage to just by sheer willpower, overcome the power of drink without 12-step programs at all and without any higher power.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it does not necessarily take Jesus to make someone to stop drinking. People can stop drinking for a variety of reasons, including trusting in something outside themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly the basis of that. Yeah.
Right. And now, but the thing is, you came to sobriety apparently through coming to Christ, and Christ has been, you know, your deliverance from that.
Uh-huh.
And yet, of course, and Christ has, and Jesus has been that for many thousands of people, millions of people probably. But the thing is that that's not all that Jesus is about. Jesus isn't just about helping people stop drinking, because others can do that. Where Jesus is unique is in that he has the power to redeem us from our sins.
Oh, yeah.
And there's no other higher power that can do that. There are many higher powers, or at least what people might refer to as higher powers. Even Paul said that in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. He said there are gods many and lords many. That is, what he meant is there are many that are called gods. You know, anything that someone worships is a god to them.
Uh-huh.
It's not a real god, but it's a god. And the very act of having a religious reverence towards something can motivate a person to overcome, you know, their lower temptations in some cases. If they think that that there's a God that they're worshiping and that he has a disapproval of their drinking, this can give them help to quit drinking, just like some men probably can stop drinking just knowing that their wife would disapprove of their drinking, or that their children disapprove of their drinking. I mean, different people have differing degrees of addiction to alcohol, and some really can overcome without any spiritual help at all.
And then I don't understand how people can say, well, my higher power told me this, or my higher power told me that. And I'm thinking, where did I get that truth from? That is what I don't get. I would have never made it since God called me out. I mean, you know, it's actually gotten worse, having any substance.
Okay, let me ask that, if I could. I mean, it depends on what they mean by their higher power told them. You know, there's Christians, many times Christians say, God told me this or God told me that, and sometimes it's their imagination.
Okay.
I mean, God does speak to people,
uh-huh.
But so do demons. I mean, that is to say,
uh-huh.
demons can impersonate God. The Bible says the devil appears as an angel of light. And so, you know, it's possible that they heard from something that they're calling their higher power, and they might call it God.
Yeah.
Whatever they may call it does not determine what it really is. You know, you can call a doorknob God, or you can call a demon
exactly what
God.
That's what they say there. They say you can have a doorknob.
Right.
God.
That's right. And, I mean, the thing is, what you call a God is not necessarily a real God because you called it that. And some people worship objects, and some people actually worship deities, if as they would understand them, which are really demons. And demons do communicate with people. But beyond that, I mean, there are both Christians and non-Christians who say that God told them this or that, and it was strictly their imagination, and they're interpreting it as God. So there's all kinds of different answers. It's not a
cut and
black
dry.
And white subject. Yeah, it's not cut and dry. It's,
that's why I like everything
different.
Cut and dry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the truth about salvation is a black and white issue. Of
yeah,
course.
That's
Jesus
how, that's
is
how
the
I
Lord.
Look at it.
Jesus is the Lord, and there's none other name under heaven given among men whereby men must be saved. But that doesn't mean there's no one other than Jesus who, if a person, you know, puts their faith in that person or thing, that they can receive some kind of help.
Yeah, because some people have just been in the gutter, I mean, as bad as you can get, and their lives have totally turned around, like, after like 15 years there, or how many years? And I just
and some do it without Jesus. And well, some of them do it without the 12 steps at all.
Yeah.
You know.
True.
There's some people who just come to their senses.
Yeah.
You know, there's some people who just come to their senses and say, "Hey, I don't want to keep ruining my life like this. I'm going to quit." But see, these people who can do that without God, I would say we're not addicted in the same degree as others who can't do it without God. I mean, there's mm-hmm. alcohol gets a grip on people. Same thing with drugs, and same thing with lots of other behaviors that people refer to as addictions. whether it's gambling or pornography or whatever, you know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, people sometimes refer to these as addictions, and for some people, the grip that these things have on their life is truly much more powerful than they are to resist it. But with others, the grip is merely a strong desire to do these things, and maybe a great pleasure they have in it, and for a lengthy period of time, they don't have sufficient motivation to resist those desires, so they just practice, they can resist everything but temptation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the time comes when there's really a reason they want to resist it, and they find that they can. It doesn't take a relationship with God to stop doing certain bad habits that are self-destructive.
That was a good line right there, what you just said.
Okay.
It doesn't take God, because I can't figure out how some of the people, I don't know how they did it without him.
Well, for some, to some degrees.
I couldn't have gotten through all the things, all the...
Well, sure.
There
are some degrees of bondage. There are some degrees of bondage to sin that people simply will never be able to get even a little bit of relief from without God supernaturally delivering them. But other kinds of habits may not be the same kind of bondage to somebody, and it's just a matter of changing one's habits. I mean, if I'm in the habit of oversleeping, and every time my alarm goes off, I hit the snooze button 3 or 4 times before I get up, that's a lazy habit.
Yeah.
But if I decide I want to stop doing that, I can do it. Now, some people might say, I can't stop doing it, I'm just lazy. Well, you can. You can, but you have to want to badly enough. But alcohol and drugs can be different than that, because alcohol and drugs can be things that your body becomes physically addicted to, physiologically. And there comes a time in some people's lives where they simply cannot stop it without some kind of supernatural aid, or at least some kind of intervention, medical intervention or something. Uh-huh. They can't just decide to stop anymore without having some kind of consequences that's going to possibly kill them, you know, withdrawals or delirium tremens or whatever. But not everyone's that far gone. I mean, not everyone who uses drugs, not everyone who uses alcohol is in that condition. And mm-hmm. for some, it's just a matter of, you know, sheer motivation and willpower. They can overcome it, whether they believe in God or not.
Well, I'm so glad I finally called you, because I've been praying about this for a month. About how is it that these people can do that? But you answered it for me. Now I'm going to have to think of more questions so I can call you back when I have them.
Okay, Lisa, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
God bless you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Marianne from Monterey, California. It's interesting, almost all of our callers today are women. In fact, I don't remember what our earliest callers were, but it seems like some days almost all of our callers are men. So it's kind of interesting. But this is Marianne from Monterey, California. Marianne, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Excuse my voice. I've got a really bad cold. I just wanted to comment on the 12-step programs and the reason. I understand what that woman is talking about. But the thing you have to remember about a 12-step program that is very similar to maybe someone going to the diabetes support group. The focus is on alcoholism, and many, many people have experienced many different things before they even drank or during their drinking. They've experienced spiritual abuse, lots of false teaching. They're in a state of confusion, and we tippy-toe very respectfully around other people's rights. No one actually believes a doorknob is God. I've been in AA for 40 years, okay, sober. And that is sort of a way for the person to begin to set down maybe a lot of false teaching that they've had in the past. Many people have had been raised by religious fanatics or in unhealthy churches, and there are lots of them. And probably most churches have a lot of unhealthy teaching and people who would be maybe not at a heart level of what they're talking about. And so the focus there is that we do not really discuss religion. People can talk about whatever they want, but there is no push for that. But I can assure that woman that having been in AA for so long and gotten to know and done a tremendous amount of 12-step work, which is carrying the message, almost everybody I've ever known comes to Jesus. God meets us at the level where we're at. We're babies. We're sick from alcohol, maybe the way of life.
So what is your message? I mean, you're calling to message to her?
That many, many people at home have a Bible sitting there and are studying the Bible and are going to Jesus and do believe in Jesus.
Right, but she was talking about people who say they don't. I mean, they say that they have God, but they don't have Jesus.
That is, everyone can speak to God about God in a general way. It is not a religious program. But God, spiritual is the part, and the letter kills and the spirit gives life. And God.
So let me see if I understand. Are you saying that those people who don't publicly say that Jesus is their higher power, but who seem to get help and seem to be able to stay sober, that Jesus secretly is their higher power and they're reading their Bible at home?
No secret. I'm talking about one-on-one. We get together after coffee. We are friends. We're interacting with each other. There we would be more open. And it's not that there's no secret. Absolutely none.
Okay, Marian, let me interrupt just a minute because, I mean, we've got other callers. I'm trying to figure what it is you're actually saying here to us. I mean, are you correcting what she said?
No. I'm explaining to her that we're on the road growing. And the first order of the day is their physical well-being. And there's almost always someone new at a meeting who's just starting.
Okay. So, in other words, I'm trying to get to the bottom line. Because
the religious
going to go in lots of different places here.
Is soft-pedaled and done very respectfully so everyone can grow at their own pace.
Okay. Well, I appreciate those comments. And I think that it's true that some people do find Christ and some people maybe even are finding Christ without knowing that's who they're finding quite yet. I mean, people are maybe growing in the direction of acknowledging Christ. But, yeah, I'm not sure exactly. I just have to say, I'm not really sure exactly what the bottom line was there, but I appreciate your call. I appreciate you going to the trouble of calling and sharing with us. Our next caller wishes to remain anonymous, and I don't know what area he or she is calling from. We do have a line or two open for you if you'd like to be on the program. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can call if you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you disagree with something that you've heard this host say. Anonymous caller, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Steve. I have two comments. First of all, I'm the same age as you, and I know I sound younger, but I'm proud that you actually provide material on your website and to people, and you're not constantly fleecing people for money. People like you, I'm willing to send money to support, because I know that your heart is truly after the Lord because of those very things I just said, is that you don't live for money. Money lives for you. And the old saying says, don't let money have you, but you have it. And I'm proud that you're doing that, and I respect you for that. Another thing is, the reason I'm calling anonymous, because I have a lot of injuries in my body, and I've been going through bouts of cancer and cancer surgery. And my doctor has me on 40 milligram tablets of Oxycontin. I was taking 5 a dose, and I'm down. Well, I'm taking 3 a dose every 8 hours, and then I have a push type instant medicine of 10 milligram Vicodin that I take with only 325 Tylenol. Now, they don't care if I get addicted, because in my condition that I'm in with back, neck, both my knees are gone, destroyed, and my back and sciatic nerve damage to top it off, with a chronic asthmatic who I use a lot of medicines just to breathe every day. They don't care if I get addicted. I'm one of those people that I've been on medicines for probably a year and a half now, And I've been on fentanyl patches. I've been on it all, just about Demerol and all that stuff. And if I'm saying I'm thankful to the Lord that I can have that medicine, and the majority of my medicines I can't afford because I'm a poor person, so my insurance takes care of that. But I feel it's a trade-off. My wife got ill when we were 2 years, we had been married 2 years. We were married.
If you let me interrupt just a moment here, I'm not sure where this is going. We've got a radio audience out there that's interested in knowing probably what your question is. In other words, you're telling me the story of your medical history, which I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't do much about that. But I just wonder, do you have a question related to Christianity or the Bible, or do you have an opinion?
Yes, I wanted to get. Sorry about that. I'll get to the point right now. Then, will God, is it counted as a sin for me to have to use all this medication, the pain meds that I've described? I can't function without them because of the pain.
Okay. Okay.
In
other words, even if you become addicted to them, is that a sin? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, because he said they don't care. They said I'll be on the rest of my life. But I wondered how God would feel about that.
Well, I don't speak for God, and he hasn't actually said anything specifically against that. He may have even said something favorable toward that, but not very clearly. What I mean is, in the book of Proverbs, in general, the Bible advocates people not to use alcohol to self-medicate, there are times when apparently, at least the book of Proverbs says that there's an appropriateness about that. In fact, it's possible that God created alcohol. You're not using alcohol, but I say that because they didn't have the kinds of drugs you're using in biblical times, but they did have alcohol. I mean, that's what they used to kill pain. Now we have high-tech drugs to do that, but actually in Proverbs chapter 31, King Lemuel's mother told him, verse 4, "It's not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted." Then she says, "Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more." Now, I'm not recommending that you go out and get drunk because of your pain. I'm saying that this does seem to recognize some legitimate use of drugs, in this case of alcohol, for pain killing for those who are in agony.
Where's the scripture at on that? I'm going to look it up when I get off the phone, Steve.
That's Proverbs 31.
Okay.
Especially verse 6 and 7.
Okay.
But, I would say this. I'm not in your condition, and if I were, I might do exactly the same thing you are. I strongly recommend that people not become dependent on drugs any more than they have to.
Yeah.
I've never been in constant, pain. And I'm sure that if I was, I might not take a strong stand against it. But I can say is, while I don't think it's desirable at all, I mean, I'm sure you probably don't either.
No, I don't
think it's desirable at all to be on drugs. It may be a solution that God has allowed, other than you just being in constant physical pain. And as I say, there is that one statement in Proverbs. I don't know of anything else in the Bible that specifically addresses it, but that does suggest that they're to medicate those who are in physical agony with some kind of a painkiller, which of course all they had back then was alcohol, is apparently something that is not an abomination and maybe a godsend.
Well, thank you. I think it's a godsend for my case. I'm in chronic pain all the time and severe at times. So I appreciate that. I want to get off here so somebody else will have time to call too, Steve. But you've helped me out, and I appreciate that scripture and Proverbs 30, you said. And
Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31.
Okay,
verses 6 and 7.
6 and 7. Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, brother. God bless you.
Okay, thank you, too.
Sorry about your pains. Yeah. Bye now.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we only have a minute or two, probably about 2 or 3 minutes. So instead of taking any other calls, I might just make some announcements that I don't usually have time to make. Usually if we're taking calls right up to the last minute, even when the music's playing, and then I have to hurriedly say a few words. Now I don't have to say it in quite so much a hurry. We have a website, and there's many resources that, in fact, our last caller, I think, was referring to that when he talked about how we don't charge for anything. We have many MP3 files there, lectures by myself, actually verse-by-verse lectures through the entire Bible, and also hundreds of lectures of biblical topics of importance and interest to Christians. About almost 900 lectures altogether on MP3s that you can download for free. There are other resources at the website. Those are the most numerous, but we have written resources. We have other things there, too, that are of use, I think, to you as a Christian for your Christian growth. And there is really nothing for sale there at all. We don't sell anything on the radio program, and we don't sell anything on the website. We don't have anything for sale. I don't say that in order to get compliments like the last caller gave. I say it actually because it's our conviction. Jesus said, freely you have received, freely give. It didn't cost me anything for you to download those MP3s. They're there, whether you download them or not, and you can download them for free. It doesn't cost me anything, so I obviously can't charge for them. I wouldn't want to. I want you to have them and any other resources we have available. You may notice that we do not have commercial breaks on this program. We go for about an hour without any breaks. There's no products for sale. We have no sponsors. And yet, you may not know that there are great expenses in having a radio program like this. We pay, currently we're on 5 radio stations, and we pay many thousands of dollars a month for the time that we are on the air. And it's because we're on the air that you know we're here and that you're able to listen in. Now, that money just comes from wherever God sends it from, but it's usually from listeners. So we could say, for the most part, we're a listener-supported ministry. We don't have any, you know, guaranteed income or underwriters or any of that. And if you would like to help us stay on the air, there's always a need for it. And if we ever have extra money, it's our intention to expand to other radio stations. And we've just done that, in fact, recently. We've added a couple stations in the past few months. But if you would like to help us out, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. And our website is a place where you can find those resources I mentioned. You can find our address there. If you want to make a donation, you can do it through the website. There's a PayPal link there. So you can find all kinds of things. You can find just about every kind of information you want about this ministry or about myself. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. So it's just like the name of the radio broadcast, The Narrow Path. .com. Anyone listening to this program by way of internet in the Midwest, anywhere near St. Louis, Missouri, should be alerted. I'll be speaking there at a conference with a couple of other men of different opinions about Bible prophecy. 3 different opinions will be shared. Mine is one of the 3. And that's going to be on Friday and Saturday. And you can get information about that from our website, too. The website does have a link that says announcements. That will always be a place where you can find out if I'm speaking locally in your area. If I'm not, you can book me. I don't charge to come. All right, so the address again, the website is www.thenarrowpath.com. If you're not a regular listener, hope you will become one. Check out the website. Lots of resources free to you. My name is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.